topic, I put some just a case study or some picture reading. It's all about an issue with Sony. And it's a nice story, even though it's a much older story, it's from more than 10 years ago now. But it gives us some insight into even how companies see security breaches today, because they haven't really changed that much. And it's also nice because it mentions a lot of the things that happened or that I talked about in this class. So just to give a brief overview, if you haven't read it, so in 2011, Sony suffered quite a big hack on their train station network. And at the time, they had about 77 million users' data stolen. So 77 million is unfortunately not a lot these days. Okay? So this would not really rank anywhere in the biggest data breaches we've had since. I believe the biggest one is Cam4. There was about 11 billion pieces of data stolen in that one. Yahoo also has a very large one, about 3 billion. So in that context, 77 million is big. But at the time, this was much larger than anything that had happened before. Okay? So essentially, they noticed that their servers were rebooting, and they didn't know why. They looked into it. They realized they got hacked, and somebody took some of the data. So they took some of their customers' personal details, in addition to credit card information. So at the time, and still today, well, earlier already, most countries in the world has data protection law. So if you're a company and you suffer a significant data loss, you need to report it to someone. Okay? So Sony reported it to the US government or to the different states they were operating in. Everybody was very concerned, and they actually had to go in front of the US Congress to explain what happened. So what they then said was that they were basically attacked by a super advanced adversary. They were subject to a very advanced attack. They couldn't have done anything about it. This is very common. So in the article, it actually refers to it as the Darth Vader defense. I don't know if you know Star Wars. Star Wars is Darth Vader is the big villain, right? In Star Wars. So the idea that everybody that hacks us is super powerful. They're like a big movie villain. They have so much skill, they have so much resource, that even if we had tried, we would not have been able to protect against it, right? In some cases, that is true, but unfortunately, in most cases, it is not. Okay? And it definitely wasn't the case in the case of Sony, right? Later on, they had various other people testifying. Eventually, an activist group also took responsibility for this hack. At the time, no one really knew why the attack happened, because none of the credit card information or data that got stolen obviously got used in any fraud later on. Subsequently, it came out that they were basically hacked by activists, because activists were unhappy that they were prosecuting somebody that hacked the digital rights management for PlayStation, allowing people to copy games, play games that they haven't played. So Sony made a case against this guy. He was quite a famous hacker, and his friends were not happy, so they're hacking to Sony in top of their revenge. Okay? What they said is that they actually used a very simple attack, simple SQL injection. I think everybody that's read a little bit about security and hacking, no SQL injection. At the same time, when other people looked at their system, they said, well, actually, there was no big attack here. The attack was very simple. The issue was that Sony did not protect their systems properly. They had very poor operational security, they were not patching anything on time, and they didn't really have strong security management. So the biggest thing that happened was that they had an Apache web server. It had known vulnerabilities. So if you go online, if you're running large software systems, well, even if you just run your PC, you know that you have to update every few weeks, right? It's going to tell you, you need to restart, not to update. They hadn't really done that, right? And there were known vulnerabilities in the version of their web server they were running. They never bothered to fix it, even though it was a well-known problem, and their attackers used that to hack it. So that is not really the attacker was so powerful, we could do nothing. Even though the attacker had skill, they didn't really need to use it, because it was so easy to hack it. So many people actually disputed their defense and said, well, you just happened to be really bad. The other reason that came out is that if you had payment data and you had personal information, why was your data not encrypted? Because that should be the obvious thing to do, right? And the outcome of this was that they actually mentioned that only encrypting their data would have doubled the IT requirement. So just to encrypt all that data and then having to re-encrypt and encrypt as people were logging in, as people were using it, would have doubled the need for their IT infrastructure, which would have doubled their cost. So they just took a decision not to encrypt. So solving the problem would have been very easy, but they choose not to do so because it was too expensive. Apart from that, they left their system open with very basic attack. And that's sort of a lesson to learn from this. We saw last week, we talked about different levels of attacker. At the end, we did mention these people that are extremely skillful, right? But the chance that they go after you is probably very low. The biggest thing that happens is if you are managing the security for a company, it's about doing the basics right. And that will probably prevent most of the attacks. Right. So we had some questions that we posted for this. So we said, is a security vulnerability almost related to technical aspects of the target? Is an attack always tactical in nature? And in this article, find examples of technical and non-technical weaknesses exploited by the attacker. Right. So in this article, it actually mentions a number of different things. It mentions denial of service, SQL injection, there was very poor firewall configuration, and they were using a web server with no vulnerability. Those are your technical issues. It also mentioned phishing. So phishing we'll talk about later in the course. But phishing is once again not a technical hack, more of a social engineering fraud. Like people will try to contact you, send you email, try and fool you into giving you personal information. Right. What type of adversaries are mentioned in the articles? Remember in the course we talked about bored people, bored insiders, criminals, sort of advanced persistent threats, and then finally activists. So in this case, we're pretty much activists. So Anonymous and Lulzsec is famous activist or hacker groups that are mentioned in this article. Which security services and associate mechanism is said to be capable of making this data breach less serious? So remember the concept of service and mechanism, service being the goal that we have, mechanism being the way that we want to implement it. Security service we needed in this case was confidentiality. We had a disclosure of information. The service is supposed to mitigate that confidentiality, and we couldn't provide it with encryption. Of course, as I said, they didn't do it in this case because they took a business decision that said it's going to cost too much. And hence, the problem. So they paid a much bigger price for it in the end. Right. Either the real issue was more operational. Whoever was in charge of their security systems made basic errors, like not updating things, not keeping on top of what the current vulnerabilities in software is. Now, personally, for Sony, they have quite a bad reputation. So apart from this one, which is quite famous, but actually several years later had even a bigger attack, right? So hopefully, well, we haven't heard anything from them since, so hopefully they fixed it now. But subsequently, somebody hacked into them again and stole all their unreleased movies and all their emails for the executives and made everything public, which is quite embarrassing at the time. Right. So one additional question we can think about that I didn't give. We said that security in e-commerce is very important. Last week we talked about non-repudiation, online contracting, right? So why do we think security is important when we do things online? And who is harmed by weak security and what type of damage does it cause? So the first one is maybe easy to answer. Everything we do is now online, right? We are more connected to each other than we ever were. So that is good because it allows us to do lots of nice things, but it is also bad because we connected to every single bad person in the world, right? So back when we had a physical store in a little town somewhere, the amount of people who want to rob me and want to break into my store is very little, and they have to be physically located there. Now people can steal from me wherever they are located in the world because we all connected online. The second one comes to who actually uses money when we have security issues. So there's actually three people, three entities. First of all, if I suffer embarrassing security incident, my own business is going to lose. Maybe we lose some money, but it's often that it's not like our money gets directly stolen unless we are subject to some kind of fraud. If somebody steals our customer data, their payment card, obviously we are not going to suffer really financial loss. The biggest issue that we're going to suffer is reputational loss, right? And sometimes that is even more important than the money, because money is actual money, but reputation is money in the future. If we don't look after the system properly and we get hacked, our customers will leave. And in the future, we don't get new customers. They're like, why do we want to deal with these people? Because these people are just going to lose our information. These people are not trustworthy. Their system doesn't work. Therefore, it's important to do things right. The other person that we are harming is our customer, right? Our customer, if we lose their information, will be subject to follow-up fraud, right? You have to think about how we deal with lots of institutions today. If I phone the bank, the bank asks me, okay, what is your first line of your address? What is your birthday? Can you tell me the last four digits of your phone number? Can you tell me your bank account number? And that is used to authenticate people in everyday transactions. If I lose that information, because I ask the customer that information when they sign up, how many websites ask you for your birthday, for your phone number, for your address, right? If they get hacked and somebody goes and makes this database and sells it online somewhere, then people are going to phone you up and say, hey, I'm the bank. I'll prove to you that I'm the bank because I know where you live and I know what your phone number is. Then it becomes very hard for your customer to discern that that guy phoning them is not legit, right? So if I lose this information, my customer might be subject to follow-on fraud. In addition to loss of privacy and basically people being quite keen to keep their private data private. The third one and last one maybe that suffers business suffering loss is other business, right? So once again, they might not want to do business with us because we have let them down, right? Maybe something we have done wrong opened some portal for attackers to attack them, okay? Recently, I think there was a good example of this. It was something with booking.com. So booking.com apparently has a portal that gets downloaded by hotels to be able to verify bookings made at the hotel. And then they, for some hotels, fraudsters actually phone the hotel, manage to fool the people who work there into giving them access to their system. And then from there, they got direct access to the booking.com portal. And once they were in the booking.com portal, they started attacking individual customers. Right? So this is a very complex chain. I phone up a hotel chain. The hotel chain doesn't do good operational security, manages to lose their login details to the booking.com server. Attackers go into the booking.com server. It doesn't attack booking.com, but extract information to attack customer. Because then what happened is they see the customer has a booking in 2 weeks from now for a nice hotel. They then phone up the customer and they say, I am from booking.com. I see that you have a booking at this hotel 2 weeks from now. However, we never received your payment. So we are now going to cancel your booking. The customer doesn't know what's going on because the person phoning him knows about this booking. And they know all his personal details. So it's very difficult for the customer to think, wow, the person phoning me is not actually real. And then the person will say, you need to pay again because we did not get your old payment. Pay money into this bank account. Okay. This stage it gets a little bit suspicious because booking.com probably not asking you to deposit money into bank account. Okay? But there are lots of people deposit money into bank account, lose money. Right? And this is like a chain of different people whose security is not really strong. So you could say yes, the hotel should not lose their login. You could say that booking.com should probably have stronger login for their own business customer. But you can see how this all links together. Whenever we lose a bit of data, it can all lead to further things. Additionally, if we lose credit card number and somebody else then goes and does fraud with it, goes to a store, buys an item, right? And later that merchant will give the item to the customer, which is the scammer, right? And later the real owner of the card will go to the bank and say, I did not buy this. Okay? And then the bank says, okay, we kill this payment. So the customer gets their money back if they're lucky, if the bank believes them. And then the merchant loses the money because the bank generally never loses money. Right? It's called a chargeback. So if I buy for something on a credit card, if I see this as a suspicious transaction, I have the option of declining it or killing it. And then even if the merchant already delivered the service, the merchant loses. Right? So all this information looks a little bit like not really valuable. What can we do with it? But people are actually very smart in exploiting this information. So everything is connected. Data is used everywhere in different ways. So once we even lose simple data like birthday or address, phone number, it opens up an entirely new window of fraud for everyone. Okay. So I will put those slides online so you don't have to worry about it. Okay, so let's go to the actual lecture. Okay. So just before we start, just some announcements. So today we start with the tutorial. So I think one tutorial is going to be in 415 and the other tutorial at 5 o'clock was going to be in 417. But we got emailed to say 417 broken at the moment. So both tutorials will be in AC5 415. Okay. Second thing, so last week I said I'm going to try and figure out how to record the lecture. So I managed to record last week's lecture in Teams, but I cannot do that to you because as it turns out, the university's configuration allows you to download, which you're not allowed to do. So I've spoken to IT office, they have another way that this is going to happen, but they cannot set it up for today. So from next week, hopefully, I will be making recording of all the lecture and you'll be receiving some link to view that at a later stage for your own reference. Okay. And then for next week class, no class because we have the public holiday, the Autumn Festival. So just remember that the next class is on the 24th of September. And then as per the university timetable, the makeup class is at exactly the same time, the same classroom, on the 29th of September. Okay, so starting off, let's just think about what we did last week. We talked about basic terminology of information security. We talked about the basic idea of threats, things that could possibly go wrong, services that we want to implement to prevent the threat from happening, mechanisms, the actual ways of providing and implementing the service, and algorithms being the bottom building blocks of each one of these mechanisms. We can talk a little bit about where we can find good mechanisms and algorithms and countermeasures, and we talked about standards with a little bit of view on security standards, where they come from, and how they get created, and some positive and negative aspects of that. So we talked a little bit about different standard bodies, and we talked about internet and company standards. So in today's lecture, which is also the next lecture, because this set of lecture slides go over 2 weeks, right? We're going to talk about confidentiality, and specifically we're going to talk about symmetric key encryption. Right? And this covers the course intended learning outcome 2.5, technology that impacts systems, and security mechanisms. Right. This lecture is slightly structured in two parts. The first one is sort of an introduction to security and encryption, because for a long time, whenever we talked about information security and cryptography, it was pretty much making little codes and ciphers, and it was predominantly linked to encryption. So we're sort of taking an historical view, and I'll talk later about exactly what type of viewpoints we're trying to bring across. The second part is then actually getting into state-of-the-art and modern symmetric encryption. Okay? Essentially, cryptography or crypto has fascinated people for many, many, many years. So it's actually very, very old, right? More than 2,000 years ago. Okay? And cryptology has always meant the art of making secret codes. It's basically code making, with cryptanalysis being code breaking, right? So in other words, security existed entirely based on cryptography, and cryptography was making little puzzles that we could use to hide information. So we could have any type of code, and at the same time, a lot of other people were working on how we could break these codes, right? And some codes could be quite simple, some codes could be quite complex, right? So if we just look at the simple one, can you decipher this code here? What word is this? Any idea? It's cryptography, right? So this is just somebody jumbling up the letters of the word, right? This has grown into what is we know today as crypto, or modern cryptography. These days we have non-repudiation, we have authentication protocol, we have identification protocols, we have zero knowledge, we have cryptographic commitment, lots of other things, right? So this is not necessarily a crypto course. There are some people that are very interested only in the crypto and the mathematical way of making the underlying codes, which we'll do a little bit of, but we won't cover everything. If you're really interested in looking into the history of cryptography, or even modern day cryptography, there's some good books, Applied Cryptography by Louis Schneier, The Handbook of Applied Cryptography, and Introduction to Modern Cryptography. And I think The Handbook of Applied Cryptography is great. It's actually free to read. I think it's one of the books I put on Canvas that one could read if you wanted further information about this. So why don't we go back in time a little bit? So Simon Singh wrote a very interesting book called The Code Book that covers the history of cryptography, in the idea that for a very long time, it's basically been a circle. I find a good way to hide my information, you find a way of breaking that way, I then find a better way, you find a better way of breaking it, I need to improve, the attacker improves, the protector improves. So this continual arms race between people trying to protect data and people trying to steal their data. Right? And we're going to go from the beginning, we're going to see sort of what the very first cipher was, and we're going to see that people broke it, how people thought about changing it, and then how people broke it again. And this will give us a natural progression into modern day cryptography. The first thing that we need to discuss is what we mean by symmetric cryptography. Right? So we have two models for encryption. The one is symmetric and the other one is asymmetric, that we'll discuss later in the course. So in symmetric cryptography, we have two parties. So we have Alice and we have Bob. So they are the two participants. And they want to send message to each other, and they want to attract, or they want to protect their message against external attacker, right? So in a symmetric system, Alice and Bob have the same secret. So they share a secret that only they know. So Alice knows something and Bob knows exactly the same thing. We will refer to that as the key. So Alice has a secret key, Bob has a secret key. They do not share it with anyone else. And they can use that secret key to send each other data. So Alice is going to use that key to encrypt her information. Information that we can just read is called plain text. She'll encrypt it and that will give us ciphertext. Bob will then take the same key that Alice has used, because Bob also knows that key. Decrypt the ciphertext, and that should give him the plain text back. Anyone else in the system, they are looking to either find the plain text, or ideally what they are looking for is the key, because if they can find the key, then they can decrypt any message going between Alice and Bob. Right. So, in a sense, a secure system is one where Alice and Bob keeps their secret key hidden from everybody else. And if they send ciphertext to each other, an attacker can neither see what they send, or from the ciphertext can also not recover the key. But the concept of symmetric means same on each side, and Alice and Bob has the same key on each side. Okay. So when we're dealing with cryptanalysis of these cryptosystems, there are some good basic assumptions to make. The first one is that the entire system is known to an attacker. And the only secret that there is actually a very well-known concept named Kirchhoff's principle. So this guy Kirchhoff came along and said, if you want to build secure systems, you cannot do it on the basis that people don't know what you are doing, because eventually this will fail. So in modern times, people call this security through obscurity. My system is secure and no one has hacked me because no one has figured out how it works yet. Unfortunately, figuring out how it works, if you try really hard, is not that difficult. People can reverse engineer how things work quite easily. So if I'm using a really bad cipher, but I'm sending data, no one's managing to encrypt it, purely on the fact that they don't know what cipher I'm using, is not a good idea. Because eventually they'll figure out how it works, and then once they figure out how it works, then I'm sitting with a bad system, a bad algorithm, that is then easily crackable. Right. So the idea is that even if we tell an attacker everything about our system, except for the secret key held by Alice and Bob, and our system is secure based on that, our system is well designed and is very strong. Okay. So, first example of symmetric encryption was done by Julius Caesar. It was called the Caesar cipher. It's a special case of a substitution cipher, and it was used to encrypt simple short messages for his armies, right, for the Roman Empire. So if you just look at these words, I don't think you can really guess what they are. Like earlier we had that simple cryptography thing, that was just a word jump. So if you look very quickly at these, you cannot immediately see what they are. Right? So both of these are encrypted with a Caesar cipher. Right? So what a Caesar cipher was is they used the Roman alphabet, which is still the alphabet we use for a lot of languages today. And they substitute the plaintext letter for a ciphertext letter. And in the case of the most classic Julius Caesar cipher, the shift in the value between the plaintext alphabet and the ciphertext alphabet is 3. So you can see that A moves 3 positions on. So 1, 2, 3, so it maps to a D. And then the B moves 1, 2, 3, maps to an E. Your C is an F, your B is a G. So the ciphertext alphabet is also an alphabet in order, but all the letters have moved over by 2 positions. So very, very simple to start with. This was the first case of cryptography. So how do we encrypt and decrypt? So we basically write down our substitution table first, or our alphabet substitution table. We can write down the plain text that we want to use, and then we can simply map. So we can say, okay, our H is going to map to a K, then we're going to have an E, it's going to map to an H, we're going to have an L, another O, we can have an O, we can map to an R, and then we can do the everyone. So we can do E, we can do B, E, R, R. You get the idea, right? So we simply write down our substitution table, and we can map things across. And to basically decrypt, we will do the opposite. So now the recipient will get the message, and they will use the same substitution table, the same shifted alphabet, but they will go in reverse. So they can go from K goes to H, H goes to E, they can go from the O goes to the two L's, and the R goes to the L's. So quite simple. Okay? So you can, I just want, we're going to be talking about substitution cycles a bit. So I want you to maybe just try it. So I'll give you a couple of minutes, and you can try to decrypt message 1 and message 2, knowing that it's encrypted with a Caesar cipher, shift 3. Okay. I'll give you about 5 minutes. anyone have answer for one? Everyone did two. So the answer for one is 84 and 7 years ago. So 84 is a very old ancient English word for 80. No one uses anymore. So it's 87 years ago. And the second answer is SpongeBob SquarePants. So if you managed to get that, good. You got part of it, so good. Basically picked up how substitution cycle works. Concept, very, very easy to understand. Just mapping one single word to one single other word. Okay. Okay. So the weakness of the Caesar cipher is obviously that we only have 25 different, should we call it keys? Because if we're doing the encryption, we always have to shift the alphabet. And the alphabet can only really shift 25 points. After that, it just becomes the same as shifting it by 1 or by 2 again. So if I figured out how it worked, it would be very easy for me just to try all possible combinations to see what the message is. Right? So people moved on very quickly from what Caesar had, which was just simply shifting the alphabet, towards making it basically a complete permutation of the alphabet. Okay, so there were a variety of ways of doing this. Right, so one way that people could do this, which is also a good way that people say that you can create password, is to have some kind of passphrase or quote that's easy to remember. So in this case, for example, we have pure mathematics is in its own in a way the poetry of logical ideas, which is a quote by Albert Einstein. And we can basically generate a substitution table by just taking the first letter in each case and stripping out the repeating letters. So what we can do is we can have our sentence. This is the first time that the P will occur, so we'll write down the P. Then the first U, the first R, the first E, the first M, A, T, and H. And then we say, okay, but there's an E here, but we had an E before. So we're just going to ignore it. We also had an M before. We also had an A before. We also had an E before, so we ignore it. Okay, now we have an I. So I is new. C is new. S is new. We already had an I. We already had an S. We already had an I. N is new. These three are the same as before. The W is new. The Y is new, getting sort of to a stage where we had most things before. O and F, L and G, D. And then we take the second line and we write them down in order, right? And those become the first part of the substitution alphabet, right? So we end up with the substitution alphabet, and then basically we can just fill in the rest with letters we don't have. And that's just maybe the, in this case, it's the reverse order. All the letters, we did not have that. Right? So obviously this random permutation of the alphabet is much less likely to be guessed as a Caesar cipher would be. Okay, so it's very unpredictable. So now we move from basically just a shift of the alphabet towards a completely random permutation of the alphabet. Right. So the idea of a substitution cipher in contrast with a shift cipher is that our entire alphabet is random or appears random to somebody else. So the big family of cipher that works in this way, where we substitute one letter for another letter, is substitution. And the Caesar cipher we look at first is called a shift cipher, which is a special case of this because we shift. So in a true substitution cipher, everything is random. So here we have a message, which can decrypt the Department of Computer Science. And the entire concept of it is very easy to understand. Right? So it's almost like if we are typing on a keyboard, we know what all the letters is, but somebody comes and changes the letters on the keyboard around. So we basically have this word, it will map exactly to one other word, and hopefully that will obfuscate or hide the message enough for it to be hidden. Right. And overall, this ends up with quite a good cipher, right, on the basic level. So if somebody would just present you with a lot of text, you can obviously see that you cannot really just decrypt it pretend like our little example is the X5 form, whatever. It actually looks quite random, right? So the question we need to ask ourselves, how secure is this, right? And to think about that, we have to think about, okay, what are the different ways people can attack it, and how secure would it be against different types of attacks, right? So if we think back to what we said symmetric encryption was, right? And we said that Alice and Bob each had a secret, and that this secret is basically what makes the cipher work. When we had a shift cipher, the junior senior cipher, the shift cipher, what was that key? What was the thing that Alice and Bob needed to know to be able to send and receive the message? Any idea? The value of the shift, right? So Alice must know she's shifting her alphabet by 3, and Bob must know they're shifting the alphabet by 3, or 4, or 5, or 6, or whatever they choose. When we have a true substitution cipher, what is the key? We're not shifting the alphabet anymore. So what is the key when we have substitution cipher for real? Any guess?
Sentence
would be, yes. So sentence, good one. So that is an example. That example we chose about how we made the alphabet with the sentence, that means Alice and Bob will both know the sentence. Okay? If we use some other method, or if we consider that Alice and Bob might use various methods, at the end of the day, in a true substitution cipher, the key is this alphabet. Right? So however Alice and Bob creates it, Alice must have this alphabet, and Bob must have the same alphabet. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to send each other information. For an attacker, for the attacker to win and decrypt information, the attacker must be able to guess this alphabet. So this method is extremely simple. So if we look at it, we can say, maybe we could write a program to guess alphabet. We can just write brute force search algorithm. Right? How secure would that be? So actually, the total number of permutations we can have for this alphabet is 26 factorial. Basically, 26 times 25 times 24 times 23 times 22 all the way down to 1. That's actually a massive number. It's equivalent to an 88-bit number, a very large number. So if I was to write a program that's going to brute force search for the right alphabet permutation, if I had 1 million desktop PC, each one can do 3 billion searches a second, my search engine will take more than 4,000. Okay. So now we see that against this specific attack, brute force, this very simple cipher is actually not that bad. In fact, even today, if the attacker could only use brute force attack, this cipher would still be pretty good. In fact, better than theirs in terms of resistance to brute force attack, which is something we used up until 15 years ago, but some people still use. So the question comes, is there anything better that we can do to crack the cipher? Because obviously we don't use substitution cipher anymore. Yet, for certain attacks, it's very good. So what happened to substitution cipher that made it easy to break? What is the problem with it? Okay, so on that note, before we can take a break, because it's 10 minutes to 3, so you can spend your break thinking about